It's the notion that a civilization originating out of like Eurasia, where Russia is now, was the dominant culture globally for a period of time that was long enough for their technology and architecture and culture to essentially diffuse all over the world. And that that culture has been removed from history on purpose to obscure things that do not jive with the historical narrative that we've all been taught. We didn't build this stuff, and that's why we can't explain it. The technology used to build these buildings is a technology that has been lost or hidden. And as part of hiding that technology, this entire civilization has basically been wiped from history, which then suggests that our history isn't just slanted. Like, you know, we get the, like, we were the good guys in every war, and it just happened that the good guys won every war. It's like it could be true that history is entirely different than what we've been told.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming by for another episode of the Ben Werman podcast. We have a new type of episode today. This is a new theme. We love dipping into these new things. And I was actually recommended to Mr. Scott Deedles here by Peruvian Bull, a good friend of mine, who was my very first episode. I also had another one with him recently. We've just been going down all sorts of weird rabbit holes together because we traveled together for like 6 months and just infinite conversations. And I know that you two have also been in group chats and whatnot talking about this stuff. So Scott Deedles, thank you for coming to join me today to talk about Tartaria.
Right on, man. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, Ben. I had actually forgotten there was Peruvian Bull that had connected us. And yeah, it's amazing the people you meet in the space once you start. One thing about Bitcoiners, I think, is it's almost a prerequisite to be critical. You have to be a critical thinker, right? And so that's not something you can just switch off. And I have found people in the Bitcoin space are interested in all kinds of stuff.
But a critical thinker who doesn't care when people give you flack for questioning things that are the unquestionable, you know? And I think that's the most important part, is like, there's so many things that have been so drilled into our brains since birth that you just can't question this. And these people don't care. And that's why we're seeing such huge enlightenments and huge quantum leaps going on for Bitcoiners. I love to see it.
Totally, man. You know, like, I think, for me, it's like Bitcoin should be the start of the journey. So if you've realized successfully that the money and the financial system is fake, don't stop there, because you know, there are a lot of other things that have a high probability of not being exactly what they thought they were. And if you've got this far, you've likely thickened your skin enough that you're, you know, fine with what other people at the dinner table might think. So I think there's lots of more stones to be turned over yet.
Or even better, if you're crazy like me, and when people get mad at you and just throw like these emotional arguments, it makes me more convicted that I'm right, because the only lashback you get is just, you can tell that it's purely emotional. There's no logic there. And yeah, that's like the perfect proof that like this isn't built on logic. Like the ideology people have built up about all these things, about the way that the financial system works, the way, you know, our health system works, which has been a big theme I've done on a podcast forever, and what we're going to talk about today, the way that our history is written, like the very like core components of the history of our species on this earth, you know, like what could be more important than that? And I'm really excited to get into it. But before we start going there, could you just give us a quick background on who you are, like where you came from and how you got into this Bitcoin / truth seeking rabbit hole diving place you are now?
Yeah, for sure, man. My Bitcoin origin story is I've sort of 15-20 years in traditional finance. I spent most of my working career in compensation rewards and pension consulting. So I actually found Bitcoin by accident in 2020. I'm a Canadian. Canada went really wild with money printing, and, you know, paying people to stay home, paying businesses to stay closed, paying businesses rent. And I just was actually concerned about the fixed income portions of the pension funds that I was managing for my clients, and started really going down the inflation rabbit hole, kind of orange pilled myself by accident. So that's kind of that piece. The bigger part, you know, I think I was naturally predisposed. Once I actually got through the initial phase of understanding like the technology of Bitcoin and getting past my own initial biases that had been created for me by the media, all these things, I've been somebody who's always sort of like never been afraid to take a different position on thinking about things. This bigger topic, you know, today we're talking about history. So I didn't come from a finance background. I actually did a history undergrad degree. So I've been interested in history my whole life. All, you know, world history as part of my, undergrad degree. I had a minor in art history, which was largely composed of, the history of architecture. So this is just actually something that was interesting for me anyways. And then when I finished my studies, this is going back a long ways, but I spent 5 years traveling the world after I finished my, university studies. So I'm also a little bit of an unusual person. I've been a lot of places. You know, I've been to the Great Wall. I've been to the pyramids at Giza. I've been to the Acropolis in Athens. I have seen these places in person. And along the way, I have always been sort of like walking and traveling by foot so that I could appreciate the architecture that I've been studying in history. So that's kind of the short of it. This subject to Tartaria kind of crossed my path. I can't remember exactly how, same thing, like you were saying, and my algorithm found it. And then like, I'm like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And so it's been something I've been looking at now for, I don't know, 6-12 months, something. And I will just say, I think it's a fascinating concept. You know, I was like, personal disclaimer before I get started, everything that I'm going to talk about right now is not necessarily like a personal belief. I may believe some of these things, but I'm also, you know, talking live. So if you're listening and you decide you want to fact check me on something, like, please don't. I don't care. It's easy to get things wrong on the fly.
This is all for entertainment purposes. That's only. Right. Whatever, blah, blah, blah. We're idiots.
This is me presenting stuff that I have found looking at this subject over the last while. And, you know, and I think like as a starting point, most counter narrative theories for me have an origination around something that is actually grounded in reality. And I actually think this is a good place to start. Because there are certain aspects of this Tartaria thing that are objectively grounded in fact. And I think that is why there is actually tons of people following this content. You see videos on Instagram or Twitter, and it's like 400,000 views. So there is something about this narrative that does attach to things that are real. And so I think we can, I'll start with a few things and we can get into like maybe where it is from there. So the first thing that's absolutely true is that at some point in the last 200 years, there was a global architectural monoculture. And an easy way to think of these, this style of buildings, I would say, are the state capitol buildings. So if you look at Montana and Iowa, for example, they're identical buildings. And those buildings actually look exactly the same as the Alberta Legislature building in Edmonton, Canada, where I grew up. And the White House, St. Paul's Cathedral in London, the Queen Victoria Building in Sydney, Australia. So this is a kind of like granite and limestone with domes, pillars and columns. Like this style is truly found all over the world. We were building this, people from every country in a time recently, thought to be recently, were building these buildings. Fact. More broadly, there's sort of like a larger style of architecture that you can find in countries all over the world where it's large portions of cities. So this is, you know, Japan, Argentina, all across Europe. So like Vienna, Budapest, and even in North America, you know, Chicago and Winnipeg, there are lots of places that have these sort of like smooth stone buildings, you know, large portions of the old sort of downtown core where there's just a consistent style of architecture that is sort of indicative of or matches the time period of those, you know, really grand state capitol buildings.
And what is the estimated time period, or are we going to get to that later?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's kind of like what's called the long 19th century by modern historians, which is kind of the period between American independence and the French Revolution. So like the 1775, 1790, all the way to the start of World War One. So this is a sort of a period in time that what is actually considered to be like a time of cultural flourishing. This is like Mozart and Bach, you know, symphonies and Rembrandt art, and you know, the invention of the steam engine and electricity, Thomas Edison. You know, so this is a period where what we've been told is the human population was really starting to explode as a result of you know, the invention of toilet paper in 1857. And so, you know, so that was a time where things were really rolling. And I think that's when most of these buildings are thought to have been built. Another thing that is absolutely true is there's this curious thing that started happening in 1851 in London. And this is another, like, one of these things is like that I remember learning about in a history class in university, the World's Fair that was in London in 1851. And World's Fair started happening in 1851. And there was like, I don't know, 30 or I think there was more than 30 that happened all around the world between 1851 and 1915. So that's a fact. And, you know, often these things were happening like one a year or more than one a year. So there would be a World's Fair in San Francisco, and the next year there would be one in Atlanta, and the next year there would be one in Belgium. And these, they have like, you know, the gate figures on these things. There's like huge numbers of people traveling all over the world to attend these things like every year. And what people have been paying attention to with these things is that each time a World's Fair ended, the entire site was destroyed. So it's like an insane amount of construction and preparation would have gone into these things, because there are photographs of them and what appears to be like really beautiful and massive compounds created and then immediately destroyed, which is just kind of weird because of all the work that would have gone in. And these things were only like, you know, an exhibition that would be running for 6 months or 12 months, and then they would just completely nuke it. And the one that I think got my attention and seems to be like one of the more curious and popular ones is the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, because there are some like really great photos that have survived of Chicago, the Chicago World's Fair. And it was an area created called the White City. And the White City is, for me, when I first saw the photos of the Chicago World's Fair, it kind of actually made the hair on my neck stand up, because it's like looking at almost like an episode of the original series of Star Trek, where some alternate timeline has happened, and there's like basically ancient Rome in the center of Chicago. And
it's literally like that utopia meme, like what the world would look like if X thing happened. It literally is like a different world.
Yeah.
I've seen it too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's true. You know, like this absolutely happened. There's no like debating it. The suggestion is that these buildings were all temporary and were made out of like paper mache and plaster. And that was how they were able to accomplish building all this stuff in such a short time. Because there are also records of like how long they say it took them to do this. But it's like Chicago has like canals, bridges, water features, like really mature plants and vegetation, like all these things. It's pretty like, I don't know, it's tough to believe. I mean, in the case of Chicago, the Museum of Science and Industry has survived. That was a building that was said to be built for that building. And the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago is one of these buildings that is representative of this global architectural monoculture. And they say it was rebuilt after, but there's nothing temporary about it. You know, like the blocks of rock that compose this thing are like, you know, hundreds of pounds each. And this thing would have taken years to build. You know, like it's really elaborate, ornate, built to last. These buildings last forever. You know, this is something that I just have found interesting as a Bitcoiner, is like another thing that is true about all these buildings is like they really don't age. You know, like they have lasted, and it like the standard for quality and how we were thinking about building things that it would have endured at a minimum is just like a major red flag for how disposable our culture has become. And I talk about this in different presentations. It just is pointing out an obvious fact that I think central banking has created this sort of parasitic leeching, where now the byproduct of our modern civilization, or one of them, is that everything is completely disposable. And that's just a problem, whether you believe in any of these other things or not.
I just watched a documentary recently called, I think, The Lightbulb Conspiracy, and it just talks about this idea of planned obsolescence, which is exactly what you're talking about. For people who haven't heard of this, essentially the idea of intentionally all these corporations are just started creating products that they want to break down over time, so people have to go buy new ones and they make more money. And this happens, it's happened across all the different products, including architecture, like you said, like, you know, they get to build more buildings if it all gets blown down. And we see, like, in all these infinity wars happening all over the world right now that the military industrial complex is funding here in the USA. We love blowing up just entire cities so we can then go in and build the whole new one and get contractors to go in and build it. Like, it's like a really destructive way of all of this happening. And that didn't used to be that way. Like you said, these old buildings we look at are a great example of when things used to be built to last and be beautiful and amazing.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, I talk about this in my book, and I think, like, one of my favorite Bitcoiners is Michael Dunworth, and Dunworth has always said to me,
I had him on recently too. He's awesome.
Oh yeah. That guy's amazing. You know, Mike says that when money works properly, it provides people the ability to plan for the future with certainty. And that's another way of explaining how time preference works, right? But if you think about it that way, money working properly would just enable us to think differently about the decisions we make. And that's a good thing, I think. The next thing after the World Fairs, which is another weird thing, and this also relates to Chicago, is the history of great fires. So I think most people are aware of the Great Chicago Fire. This is like a really, you know, important piece of kind of American lore. And like, even as a non-American, I knew about the Great Chicago Fire.
I don't know it. Could we get a quick review of that?
Oh yeah, for sure. So in 1871, there was a fire that destroyed 18,000 buildings in 2 days. And the official story is that a donkey kicked over a kerosene lamp, and that was how it all got started. And so there's like a little, you know, poem or like, you know, kid's story about this.
Equally as dumb as like the Maui and the LA fire stories.
Yeah, totally. Basically, yeah. I mean, especially considering that these buildings were like, you know, there's pictures. There are also photographic evidence of the aftermath of the Great Chicago Fire. And the buildings that were destroyed are like, they're all brick. So brick doesn't even, you know, like there. So there's a basic problem right there. Just in North America, though, there were actually multiple great fires. So if you go through the history of great fires, Great Fire of New York, Great Fire of Pittsburgh, Great Fire of Toronto, Great Fire of Boston, Great Fire of Seattle, Great Fire of Vancouver. And it was actually the Great Fire of Seattle that that really clicked for me, you know, as I was on this journey, because, World's Fair Chicago, Great Fire Chicago. I have been to Seattle a bunch of times because I live on the West Coast of Canada. And, you know, there's part of the Seattle, like when you go there, you can tour the underground of Seattle. So there's actually like a whole Seattle underneath Seattle, and streets, shops, everything. And they're like, oh yeah, they just it's like, you know, we just built on top of the old one. And everyone's like, okay. And then yeah, there was some great fire, and it's like, oh okay, that's weird. So a few cities have great fires. That's nothing to see here. Sure.
And Seattle's so, my home city. I still haven't gone to do that. Like, this is how recently I've been learning about this stuff. It's like I've always heard about these underground cities when I lived there. And it's like, oh, it's a fun tourist attraction to take the family and go see this cool underground world that you've never heard of. Like, no one asks any more questions outside of that. It's like,
yeah. You don't so we're all it. Still just in like the facts of stuff that actually, and it's bizarre, man. And I think part of what goes on with this, it's like the prestige is the part of a magic trick where you're staring right at it, and the actual trick happens right in front of your face. And so we are, I think, you know, and this is why I love the buildings, because the buildings are sort of like an irrefutable smoking gun. Regardless of how you want to look at them, the buildings physically exist. You can go examine them yourself. And the issue is just like, when we're looking at all this stuff, we are forced to sort of like wedge our understanding of what we're looking at into a timeline, or, you know, we've all learned some history in school, you know, and the school system itself, we basically, all of us came up through a school system that was taken over by the Rockefellers at the turn of the of the 20th century, and really started shaping how people were learning and what they were learning. So for the last, you know, longer than anyone who's alive today, the education system has actively been curating what we're how we understand basically everything. So now is where it starts to, I think, kind of get into the more the threads that people start to really pull at. And
my favorite.
Right. So the first one is so now we're talking about Tartary or Tartary. This country, the name Tartary, does appear on older maps, on multiple older maps. And what is also fact is that the accuracy of old maps would have meant like the, you know, business survival of the map maker. So in the old world, maps had a lot of value, and they would have had to been right. So, or, you know, to the best of the map maker's ability. And so multiple maps show Tartary, and it's, you know, the landmass where Russia is currently now, but in some maps, it's all the way into China and Western Europe. You know, this is potentially, I've seen maps where it's a huge part of the sort of Eurasian continent. And the most famous one is a map called Mercator's Map, which is 1632. And this is like a highly detailed map, like recognized map. And so there are kind of like, you know, official explanations of why this is in there. And sort of like say, you know, we didn't really know a lot about the you know, the mysterious Far East, and they were guessing, you know, like I've had people come at me about, you know, the day after a dinner party where I start talking about this stuff, and it's like, oh, Google told me that this is that. So again, this is why please don't bother doing that. If you're listening to this, I've heard all this stuff. I don't necessarily believe all this. I think it's interesting. So there's the map. I would say though,
piece. Like from the different rabbit holes I go down, Google is almost always the exact opposite of the truth in what it feeds you. And YouTube algorithms, they're always going to feed you the lies. It just seems like that's too crazy of a rule to go by, too crazy of a rule of thumb. Why would our, you know, glorious big tech search engine just always give us the exact opposite of the truth? It's because all these things we learn about, like there's just such a deep level of corruption going on since the Rockefeller built it up. Like you said, it hasn't changed. It's gotten worse.
Yeah. I mean, in these power structures, I think truly do just change hands, and they get passed down or passed forward. And there is an elite class of people. And it's not weird to think that if there was a group of people that were really orchestrating global events, they would probably be interested to preserve that and not have the rest of us even be aware that it was going on. So I don't think that's it really like a controversial idea.
Yeah, it makes complete sense because it really serves the people who are ruling us for us to think like, oh, this is the best we've ever been. We are at the top of civilization, and they will do anything they can to hide the past because, like you mentioned this, how you went on your 5 years of traveling the world after college. I did the same exact thing. I went to different places than you, but similar sort of synapses started forming of just when I went to Europe. I you know, went to Italy and France and England and seeing these incredible buildings everywhere that were built. And I'm in Argentina right now. Same thing. Tons of just beautiful architecture everywhere. I look at it much differently now, just knowing like, you know, this is exactly what the powers that be of the current world are trying to block out from us and lie about and diminish. And I think that's where we're going to go with this is, you know, what the splitting of the truth and the lies based on, you know, what evidence we have. And it's continue.
Yeah, man.
Sorry,
so to come back to like what I was just saying before, you know, it's like the only thing we can do in the current paradigm is look at a building like that. And our brain has to say, wow, our great-great-grandparents just really knew how to crank out immaculate buildings that never degraded over time ever. That's really amazing. Well, what are we having for lunch? You know, it's like, but photographs. So there's also some really unusual photographs from this time period. There's photographs of like a lot of the biggest cities in the world that are totally empty, like, you know, a panoramic aerial photo of San Francisco or St. Petersburg, where there is not a single person on the street, which Google will tell you that's because the exposure time was different in photography at that time. And people were moving so quickly that they just actually weren't captured in the photo, which is sure. So anyways, objective fact, there are photos of the biggest cities in the world empty, which is odd. Railroads.
What date is that, just for reference?
These are photographs dated to the 19th century, somewhere in the 1800s. There's lots of different date ranges.
I think that's the part that I need constant reminders on, like all these different timelines, because I think that is what this ultimately comes down to, like what is the timeline we were told and what is the timeline we think may have actually been what happened.
Yeah. Pictures of lots of pictures of like the American Wild West and the construction of railroads, where there's photos of railroad sites that are being represented as like, we're building a railroad, but the picture looks like they're digging it out of the dirt. It doesn't look like they're laying tracks. It looks like the railroad is buried and they're unburying it.
Okay.
And it's the same thing with like the New York subway. As far as I can tell, there's photos of the ribbon cutting announcing the opening of the subway of New York, but there aren't photos of the digging of the tunnels, which is an odd thing for such an incredible human achievement. You would have thought, since the camera did exist, that they would have been documenting a lot of these things along the way. There is a problem with like construction timelines, and this is another reason why I really like the buildings. And I want to give a shout out to a YouTube channel called My Lunch Break. So if you're listening, you're interested in this, I've been following My Lunch Break. This is kind of like where I get some of the information. Why I like My Lunch Break is they're just digging into things that are sort of like fact checkable on our own. So when was this building built? How long did they say it took to build? Based on what we know about building now, does this story make sense? And even just in that stuff alone, there's a lot of really interesting information. One of these is the Empire State Building. So the official story is that it took 405 days to build the Empire State Building, and which is a really astonishing fact. And if you Google this now, they'll just say like, our ChatGPT will tell you that we used to be a lot faster at building skyscrapers. And I ChatGPT this before the episode just because I was interested. The Empire State Building is 102 stories. And the average time it takes today to build a 100-story building is 5 to 7 years. And they cranked out the Empire State Building in 400 days, which is incredible fact if that's true. It's like, so even just that on its own, as a standalone fact, it's amazing that in the last 80 years, we've gotten like hundreds of times slower at building tall buildings. There's lots of problems like this. And going back to like, this is another thing that really started to like pique my interest, because the Alberta Legislature building in Edmonton, again, where I, this is a building that I kind of like spent my whole life looking at, and it's kind of a place my parents would take us as kids. You kind of walk around, and the story about that building is that it was built in like a year and a half or 2 years. Edmonton is like one of the least hospitable physical environments that people actually live in, and the construction season there is very short because the winters are absolutely brutal. And in 1913, when they say this building was started, Edmonton was like 18 or 20,000 people, and it's like, this is a straw, like a two-horse town with like woodshed houses and then this one incredible stone building. Like, it's just, what logical explanation would we have to allocate the resources to do this? Lunch breaks on some really interesting things too. Like, you know, to imagine that these buildings, and it's the same for the state capitol buildings across the U.S. This predates power tools. It predates cars. So people would have been, moving these materials with like horse and buggy. And so then you need to actually just functionally think about like, well, how many horses would you need to do this? And how much water does a horse drink every day? So how much water would you need just to have the horses you would need to even move the materials to accomplish, again, these, because all these buildings have published completion timelines. So, you can kind of like reverse engineer the math. And this is like, these are, again, just factual threads that don't have a lot of like, that have some curiosities. Other weird stuff, this is like the Great Wall of China is facing the wrong way. So the fortified part of the Great Wall of China is facing China, which is a very unusual, like, strategic decision. If you were going to build a wall that's three times wider than in the continental United States, And take 1,000 years. It's a big oops if they fortified the wrong side. There's some interesting stuff I've seen about the there also being a problem with the math potentially around the growth of a human population. So the accepted narrative is that right now we're somewhere around 8 billion people, and that number has been exponentially growing over the last 200 years. And that has been attributed to advancements in technology that correspond to this time that we've been talking about. And so the, if you're working with the numbers that we actually have, you can also work backwards. So to say that the human population globally is decreasing by about 2/3 every 69 years. So 8 billion down to 2 billion, I think around the Depression, working backwards, that is about 928 million people globally in 1886. And that's, I think, about as far back as we have actual numbers. But if that rate is consistent, that would mean that there was around 300 million people in 1815 and about 100 million people in 1750 and about 30 million people in 1680. So either something really changed about the rate that we reproduce over the last 200 years, or there's some issue with so why this matters is 1817, 300 million people on the whole planet. Like, this is the time where we're cranking out like thousands of these immaculate buildings that would have required like master masons, master architects. Where are all these people coming from, and who have the skills to actually produce these things in the physical world? And I always come back to Chicago. I think Chicago is such a fascinating example because the entire population of the territory of Illinois in 1810 was 7,000 people. So we have this Great Chicago Fire that happened in 1871. So this is 60 years later. And just in that one fire, 18,000 of these stone buildings were destroyed. So in 60 years, starting with a population of probably a lot less than 7,000 people in Chicago, they built they're cranking out thousands of these stone buildings. Like, it didn't just destroy the whole city. So there was obviously a lot more than that. And, how were they able to get all this done? It's just like this thing with building the Empire State Building in 400 days. Like, so what has happened then, if all those numbers are right? And how can it also be true that we are now the most advanced people humans have ever been, and it's taking us 7 years to build a skyscraper and all these other things? So there's just, it's tough to explain how all these pieces could like possibly fit together. So I think that's probably like, maybe that's the, if we were to stop there, the Tartarian theory in a nutshell is that we didn't build this stuff, and that's why we can't explain it. And that these buildings are actually probably a little bit older than we think they are. And that the technology used to build these buildings is a technology that has been lost or hidden. And as part of hiding that technology, this entire civilization has basically been wiped from history, which then suggests that our history isn't just slanted. Like, we get the, we were the good guys in every war, and it just happened that the good guys won every war. It's like it could be true that history is entirely different than what we've been told.
I love it. And that was going to be my very next question, to like have sort of a checkpoint, because I think we've done a great job sort of laying some foundation, just that there's a lot of funny business out there that we don't have an explanation for. Like how are all these incredible structures everywhere that were supposedly built during the time where there was just no technology, no power tools, no like horses walking around, and you know, like what the heck happened? And I think that more and more people, like, this started to become mainstream for people to like really look at the history that we have been told and think, maybe there's something very different that happened. And a lot of people know Graham Hancock. He's sort of brought that in mainstream a little bit through Joe Rogan's episodes, talking about how there's like a super advanced civilization, you know, over 10,000 years ago that was completely wiped out. This seems like this is a similar type of idea, where there was a civilization that was like much more advanced than us, like quite recently, actually, that was wiped out by the quote unquote mud floods. And maybe that's where we can sort of go, and like to kind of give, I'd love to just have like an overview. You just talked about the Tartarian theory. If we could just kind of do like a TLDR, if you just got in an elevator with someone and they ask you like, what is the deal with this Tartaria conspiracy theory? Like what is the super summarized version of it, just to kind of have that checkpoint for people as we get into the deeper weeds?
Yeah. It's the notion that a civilization originating out of like Eurasia, where Russia is now, was the dominant culture globally for a period of time that was long enough for their technology and architecture and culture to essentially diffuse all over the world. And that culture has been removed from history on purpose to obscure things that do not jive with the historical narrative that we've all been taught.
And so you mentioned mud floods. That roughly, like, based on a Tartarian theory, what, how long was that empire?
Yeah, this is where I think it gets a little bit more out of the, you know, we've stepped out of the things that you can absolutely cannot argue.
I want to step out of the official narrative. Let's go.
So I think it's kind of like what I've seen. The suggestion is that it was not a single event, but that it's been sort of an ongoing process, and that the start of that process might have been marked with the Great Fire of London, which happened in 1666. So London had its own Great Fire. And this is why this thing about Great Fires is so interesting. This is another event that, as a history student, everybody just learns about. These ancient cities having these massive fires. So because after the Great Fire of London in 1666, that's when you have you know, George Washington, and this is when Freemasonry is coming into the picture. And the construction or the said timeline of these things happening in the United States. And so this is where I think the idea is that it would have been a period that predated 1666. And so all of these buildings are thought to be older than, basically much, much older than the United States entirely. And this is why, like, you have, you know, basically ancient Greek and ancient Egyptian structures in Georgia and Tennessee. And people just look at them, and again, these are things we have to fit into our own timeline. But like, there is a perfect replica of the Acropolis. Like, I'm pretty sure it's in Athens, Georgia. And it's just odd things. So Chicago is like, you know, in some of these older maps, there is a city called Chilaga that is in the same spot Chicago is in now. And, you know, this is kind of like, these are odd things. Like, there are these really old maps where oftentimes California is indicated as an island. And these would be more unusual mistakes for map makers to be making. Like, and it's more than one map. So Yeah. So the idea is that these buildings are a lot older than we think they are. And the second part of that is that we actually don't even understand what these buildings were probably being used for, and that the structural element in the design is not purely aesthetic, and that there is a technology that is so advanced in these buildings that we don't even comprehend what they were being used for. So there's like kind of two of these, I would say. One are cathedrals. And the cathedrals are, this is another thing, right? If you're into traveling and you're into history like I was, like I've been to every cathedral in Europe and they're just so cool. And the one that I talk about a lot in presentations is the Duomo in Milan. If you ever get the opportunity to go to Milan, in my opinion, the Duomo is the absolute pinnacle of human achievement in terms of things that we have ever built. Like it is actually, it's completely awe-inspiring and it's mind-boggling. Like it's hard to comprehend that human beings threw this thing together before the invention of toilet paper. And we hadn't thought of toilet paper yet. Just think about that for a second, right? We hadn't solved that problem, but we had solved the problem of building the most ornate and beautiful structure in the world. So these buildings have recurring sort of sacred geometric patterns, a precision of symmetry that is even today difficult to replicate. And it's not just building it, but it's like the mathematics behind doing this is just so sophisticated. And the rose windows. So cathedrals have these rose windows that are actually cymatic patterns, which is when a sound wave is visualized. If it's passed through something like sand or water, we can see what sound looks like in the physical world. And these are what they were building in rose windows. And so I've seen some really interesting stuff suggesting that organs in cathedrals were actually some sort of like healing, sound healing technology, and that they were passing these sound waves through the rose windows. So the glass was added later as a way of removing the tech. And this is sort of an amplification system that was, they were using sound in a way that we don't understand now. And that's kind of one piece. And this is why there's a comparison of the etymology of the words cathedral and cathode. It's like these things were sort of like related to power. And the state capitol buildings, the domed buildings, were thought to be harvesting free atmospheric energy, and this is actually a sort of a core part of what I've seen of the Tartaria theory. Has to do with the notion that the Tartarians had solved the problem of atmospheric energy collection, and this is the piece that had to be removed from history, because if you have a free energy society, we essentially live today in a fiat slave society, and that is only possible in a world where energy is finite and we need to, trade our time and energy for energy that we can consume. So in a free energy world, that's going to look a lot different. And a power structure like the one we have now would be very, difficult to control, maintain. So, so there are all kinds of interesting things. The, St. Paul's Cathedral in London is a really great example where the domes have these ornate stone, I can't think of the word right now, things that sit on top of them. And there'd be
spire.
Spire, but it would have a hollow center. So it'd be like columns with a space in the middle that today is empty. And this has been there are drawings, pre-photographic drawings of how these buildings looked in their day. And in the drawings, there's actually like stuff in those empty spaces, machinery. And so these are where they've left the buildings, but they've removed you took the battery out of the flashlight. And so now you just have like a really crappy hammer. And this is kind of the idea with the domes are copper. And there would have been some sort of a device that was thought to have sort of like used mercury or some other radon, like elements we don't we've been scared away from even looking at now. And the actual buildings themselves were designed to conduct this electricity. And these ties back to the World Fairs because the 1890s was the time of Edison Electric and the electrification of the United States and Nikola Tesla. The World's Fairs were oftentimes exhibiting electrification at a scale that is really hard to explain based on what was actually technologically available at the time. And even how they would have been piping in the electricity itself, like they would have needed generators, massive generators to light up these entire city areas. And it was, you know, if we are again working with the established narrative, this technology was essentially just invented. So that would have been a very impossible
wires in these pictures. Like right. I've seen them. There's no wires anywhere. There's no like power outlets and plugs. So
yeah.
Logistically,
you know, like the story with these World's Fairs, building impossible structures of immense size on like just unbelievable timelines, and they're like wiring things at a scale that's in a way that's never been done before. And then when it was done, they had to destroy it all so that no one could see it, and that's it. So to mud floods. That's, I think, an important part of this, because this is actually also true. And this is where I think a lot of people like me start to really wonder, because what you can see when you're traveling all around the world, when you see these buildings, is that for some reason, a lot of them are buried under the ground partially. And this is true in London. It's true in Philadelphia. I've literally seen this in Sydney, Australia. There are buildings where there will be a window on the ground floor that is 80% buried. And it's like, why would anybody build windows that are going to be buried underground? They wouldn't.
Seattle's completely underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Or buildings where there's like, yeah, so there's floors underground, or like so the mud flood theory is a attached theory to Tartaria, that actually what caused the end of this time was some kind of like geological event that this is why the buildings that survived are buried. And this is kind of like where people are trying to, I guess, come up with a theory that explains why people that were so great at building would have made such a weird decision like building windows into the ground. It's because maybe there was something that caused the average height of the ground to change. And this is thought to be like a sort of like large scale kind of liquefaction where the ground became soft and sunk things and there's tons of photos of Kansas City basically being dug out of the dirt. And this is one of these areas that mudflood people kind of like that I've seen people point at, which is just kind of interesting. But I think like for anybody who's listening, if you really think about it, you probably have seen old buildings where there's a window sticking halfway out of the ground. And again, that's just something that is true.
Yeah. And this is another thing that just keeps popping up as you look through this alternative history rabbit hole. And I mentioned earlier, Graham Hancock, he talks about this as well, how, you know, that's the best theory he has, and which I personally, it checks out to me from all the research I've done, is that there was like a very advanced civilization, you know, 10,000 plus years ago, got wiped out by a massive flood. And that goes, and it's quite interesting as well, because that sort of brings together a lot of different ideologies, like the people who are Christians who follow the Bible. It talks about a great flood, and that meshes well with that. So like it makes sense for multiple perspectives. You don't have to be like a religious person to believe that. And this mud flood theory is sort of a similar idea, like just having a really advanced civilization just get completely wiped off the map by this crazy event. Mm-hmm. And of course my tinfoil hat is wondering, like, were these completely like random natural events, or is there some powerful force that's causing these things. Do you ever think about that? I mean, is that part
yeah, totally,
of your
all the time,
theorizing?
Man. Yeah,
because that's where it gets real weird.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's probably possible that there has been like lots of rise and falls of different human civilizations, and you know, probably the big lie is that we think that this right now, this moment, is the sort of apex of human civilization. And
it's like we're on a hamster wheel of just these resets that keep happening.
Yeah.
And we're just in the latest iteration of this little ant farm of humans. And, you know, we're told to not ask questions about these remnants of an older civilization that came before ours. And that's why this is so fascinating. Even if you're not a history buff, like just to imagine that, you know, everything that you're told about, you know, who you are and your ancestors and, you know, what ground you're like, who stood on this earth before you is completely wrong, which is, I just love it.
Yeah. It's like the, you know, the Cheshire Cat says, if you don't know where you're going anyway, we'll do. And this is like where I think I actually said this proven bill the other day where, in this idea from George Orwell's 1984 is that if you, when you've completely sort of rewritten history, then like it's something that there's more to it than just confusing people about where they've come from. It's like when people really don't understand the order of events, they have no way of like, it's impossible to sort of like find your North Star when you don't even know what direction you're facing. And, you know, it could be that George Orwell was just writing a book, or it could be that that's actually true. And we really don't have any idea how this started. And because, you know, we really, I think, you know, it's hard to say how things, you mentioned Google, like the historical narrative could be and can be continually rewritten even now. And it's really difficult for us, for any one person or people to keep track of the continuous changes. If, you know, like, let's say, as an example, 400 years ago, Tartary was on every map. And over time, interested people are just collecting these maps as they're found and taking them out of circulation. And eventually, hundreds of years later, now there's only a few maps that have it. And because there's only a few, it's easy to discredit them as, you know, whatever. And then, you know, when those few maps left are found, they're also taken out of circulation. And then, you know, a short time later, 20, 50 years, we just see on the internet is some obscure notice about a doctoral thesis at a university somewhere that says, oh, historians now think that this. And it's like, now that's the Google search result. And new, you know, this is how I think it's fluid. And, you know, I think it's fair to question everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, there's just so many lies out there, and it's so crazy to think about it. Like when you start to expand your brain and think about, you know, what is behind us and what's ahead of us, it's easy to understand why the powers that be don't want people thinking that way, because it's definitely a huge piece of you really caring about the future more. And because once you see that we've been in a much greater place in the past, like more technologically advanced, more connected to nature and more connected to healing through natural ways, like you talked about the cymatics in these cathedrals, I 100% believe that those cathedrals were energy centers and healing centers with, you know, using free energy through their spires. And I think that the pyramids were also energy centers that were, you know, getting this energy. And, you know, that's just from my speculating and like learning a lot about the stuff like you have, and just like looking at, you know, these alternative theories that just make more sense. Because the official narrative can't explain any of this shit.
Totally.
It's kind of up to us to do our best, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I would say, like, you know, the term conspiracy theorist was put forward by the CIA to discourage people from thinking critically about the obviously Swiss cheese narrative around the assassination of JFK. So anybody who, to me, you know, views critical thinking as like something to make fun of someone over, you know, that's right. But yeah, I think the issue or why it's so triggering for people is because it's the enormity of the lie. And if the idea that history might be entirely fake is, you know, it's bigger than biting off the idea that money is fake. But even in our own lifetimes, there have been lots of things that have been kind of like outright lies. And, you know, really smart people believe that human beings have stood on the moon. Like, and, you know, like, you know, so it's just as an example, if that event is a lie, then people really have to sit with the fact that, like, what we've been told is the greatest accomplishment in human history is actually the biggest lie from a government that's ever happened. And that's actually happened while people who are alive today were alive. So now go back 30 or 50 or 100 years further and imagine what kind of lies could be possible in a world where the single biggest achievement of the last 80 years didn't happen.
Yeah. And the further back you go, the easier it is for them to change it because you weren't there, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's a great perspective to look at it because, you know, once people start, I think it is easier to start from like what we've figured out, we believed in our own lifetimes, it turned out to be a lie, because then you can work your way outward to the bigger and bigger ones. And I'm with you on the moon one. And did you want to elaborate a little bit on the moon theory? Like, what are your thoughts on the moon landing?
Yeah, if you're open to going there. Stanley Kubrick filmed it in a California basement. Like, I just, you know, I mean, the footage itself is pretty laughable. And the lunar lander is like actually made of tinfoil. You know, Richard Nixon, you know, phoned the moon from a landline.
Like beach chairs.
Yeah,
beach chairs on it with like tinfoil wrapped around. It's insane.
It's really, you know, the fact that like smart people have to debate this today is really speaks to the level of cognitive dissonance and how hard it is to acknowledge that this stuff is not true. It's more than that, right? Like, imagine that we did something. Is there any other technology in the world that is 60 years old, other than building skyscrapers, that 60 years later, we can't do 1,000 times better? And like, you know, if Elon Musk is the smartest and richest person alive, and he was going to get into space, into the space game, he would have gone to the moon on the first try. You know, like everyone's clapping that he's like successfully launching a rocket. It's basically like, you know, we were doing algebra 60 years ago, and now we're doing simple addition, and everyone's like so fired up that we are doing basic math. I could talk about the moon forever, but, I think it's a really great flashpoint for like, we really don't understand maybe to what extent the power structure that is in place would go to manipulate people into believing a certain thing.
Yeah. And I want to throw out there a shout out to the podcast that really sort of completely blew my mind on the whole moon landing thing was Candace Owens had a Bart Sibrel, I think is his name. But that is an excellent podcast that basically walks through every single piece of the moon landing story and just shows how all of it's completely made up. It was a giant cash embezzlement lie.
Mm-hmm.
You can literally see like in the videos, and there's so many of these videos out there you can now look at and understand like, oh, this is how they did this. There's like air bubbles like coming up in a lot of the astronaut videos. So you can tell that they did a lot of it underwater.
The
shadows on the moon are going in different directions in a lot of pictures.
Yeah, they got a lot of stuff like wrong, you know, like even stuff like, If the Earth is four times the size of the moon, then the Earth from standing on the moon should be four times as big as the moon looks to us standing on the Earth. And, you know, there are all these photos of the Earth from the moon where the moon is, or the Earth is the size of the moon. And like, it's just, these things are fake.
I didn't know until just like a few weeks ago, there are zero pictures of planet Earth from space ever
Yeah.
All of the ones that are in the history books,
yeah,
in the documentaries and the, you know, the movies and TV shows or whatever, every single one is CGI.
Yeah.
They're all CGI. And so yeah, that is, I mean,
what's even weirder about that one is, like, I think a lot of people's first view of the Earth would have been like the Universal Movies intro, and like Universal Movies has like this rotating globe that was on their silent movies in the 1920s. This is like, you know, 40 years before or 30 years before the Russians even sent anybody into space. So I don't know how they would have even known what that looked like to do that. It's a really incredible thing.
Yeah. And speaking of really old maps that say things that are no longer the official narrative, how about those flat earth maps? Not going to go there. That's a whole different rabbit hole.
It's a whole different rabbit hole. Question so, everything.
A movie I'm curious if you watch. Have you heard of The Primordial Code by Marijn Poles?
No.
Because this is a guy who I had on my podcast a few months ago. He's a really excellent documentarian. I think you would love this. And I think I'm actually brainstorming. I might mention this as like a movie for people to watch even before this episode, because it talks about a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, in the sense of history is a lie, how these old buildings like the cathedrals were free energy centers. He actually goes in, talks to a guy playing the organ, and they sort of talk about how it's designed in such a way. So these like cymatics are, you know, healing and energy producing. So I highly recommend that. I'll throw a link to you because I think you would love it. But
cool.
I mean, this content is just getting out there to everyone. People are just starting to ask questions and like really just looking at stuff. It's exciting. You know, it's,
yeah,
it's, you go through every rabbit hole has like a certain dark element to it that you've realized you were just really lied to about something huge, but it also makes things really exciting. I think that's sort of a good transition we could take here into like, what do we do with this information looking into the future? And I mean, you're a Bitcoiner, you wrote a book, and I didn't even mention the intro. I apologize that the DAO of Bitcoin, you wrote this book. And maybe we could talk about where Bitcoin comes into this picture. How does this potentially change the timeline? Because I can't stop thinking about this, how, you know, did any of these super advanced civilizations have something like this that could potentially be a tool to prevent these cycles from repeating? Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. I actually have a few. And maybe before I go there, one thing I want to say is I'm a really big fan of a thinker from kind of the 70s and 80s named Itzhak Bentov. And he has a great book on an intro to modeling a theoretical model of consciousness. It's called Stalking the Wild Pendulum. And so this idea about Great Awakening, Itzhak Bentov suggests that sort of everything is composed of consciousness, and that the nature of consciousness itself is that it continually expands. So we are all participating in a process. The procedural nature of everything being composed of consciousness is that it's going to just continually evolve and grow. And so you mentioned Great Awakening. I think we are already underway on some sort of mass realization. Then this is, we're in the early stages, and I think it stems from the exponential human connectivity that started really like 15 years ago with the advent of like Facebook and other kinds of social media. And like, because truly, if you remember what life was like before that, and like really probably, you know, the like it's speeding up. People are getting more connected. You know, like you know, in the 90s or early 2000s. Your network was really people that you knew in real life. And, you know, like somebody like Peruvian Bull, I've actually never met him physically in person. We message all the time. So like this, you can now connect with people all over the world in a way that really is pretty new. And that's happening everywhere, and it's speeding people's ability to share ideas up. And I think that is rocketing us towards something that is like really unexpected. Like, I think we will be, I'm also a really big fan of fourth turning. And one of the ideas in fourth turning is that at the end of a fourth turning, and for anybody who's not familiar, fourth turning is a book that suggests that society runs on 80-year cycles that has to do with generations sort of living out their different stages or seasons of life. And what is happening in a civilization at a given time has to do with the season of life that the people who are in sort of the 40 to 60 age range are in, because they're the ones kind of like calling the shots. So every 80 years in American history, there's been some massive event. And after that period has culminated, things have been really totally different. And this book was written in the 90s and suggested that this period, this next turning, would be now. So in Fourth Turning, they talk about the idea that things are always like, you know, people are always worried that at once the tumultuous time is over, that things were going to go back to the way they were before. So the last turning was World War II. And what was happening just before World War II was the Depression. So people were actually worried about World War II ending because they thought the world was going to go back into a depression. What happened instead was, you know, this explosion of everything. This is kind of partly what I think is going on now with, you know, AI, the information age. I think we're headed into Bitcoin, hyper-Bitcoinization. I think we are going to actually arrive at a world in a time much shorter than most people would expect. It's going to be so different than how things are now. It will totally make your head spin. So what does this relate to Bitcoin? One of the really cool things, I think, is, you know, Bitcoin, because it is an immutable public ledger, and this is a Gigi idea, right? What is Bitcoin really doing? It is tracking the ordering of events. And so in a post-Bitcoin world, theoretically, timelines are unfuckable. It's impossible to mess around with the order of things happening, because we now have a continuous record, essentially, of everything that will be mapped out that happens on Bitcoin. And if you believe that, I believe, in the time that we're alive, everything that matters will be recorded on the Bitcoin blockchain. All of human activity. Bitcoin, to me, is a planetary technology for capturing the entirety of, you know, value transactions. And so, so this is to say, in some way, we will have a way of recording and observing everything that happens over the lifetime that Bitcoin exists. So I think we are headed into, among other things, we're going to start thinking about time in a very different way. And yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, and I would say, like, at the very least, like, the step one that we can sort of point to as, like, this is something that will finally end is that planned obsolescence I talked about, where we're in this just fiat system where it's just looking for ways to just nickel and dime people for stupid things. Like, once you have a hard money, it's a little bit difficult for me to, like, really grok that out just easily. But once you have everything's built on a sound form of money instead of a fiat money, it really shifts the entire consciousness of the people on that standard to have savings again and think longer term and lower your time preferences we love to talk about and make better stuff and invent things and create things for the long term and make more babies and just, you know, build bigger families. And like every single one of these things will start to happen once you're not just robbed by the fiat system that we're in right now. Mm-hmm. And so it is super interesting to think about these things, especially since, as I sort of alluded to earlier, I mean, we've seen all these ancient civilizations come and go now, and we have proof of that, as we can see. And we also talked about, like, could there have been, like, some force that, like, caused these resets and these, like, wipeouts of each iteration of humans? Who knows? Like, this is still a question that we don't know, but could having a sound money that really brings people together and eliminates the amount of power that the evil forces have through central banks and whatnot, could it play a piece in how things end up in the future? Could we be the iteration that finally figures this thing out and doesn't get wiped out for whatever reason?
I hope so.
Yeah,
this is actually really this is really what DAO of Bitcoin is about.
And, yeah, I want to hear about that book, man. Tell me about, because I didn't actually realize that until I was doing my research on you just in the last 24 hours. So give us a synopsis of the book and chill it for us.
Yeah, for sure, man. It is a exploration of consciousness. You know, these things that we're talking about, So Taoism is a religious or philosophical tradition that emerged out of ancient China. And in my travels, I spent a year in China while I was traveling, and I was at an age where it was profoundly impacted my worldviews. And among those things that happened during that time was I became really interested in Taoism. And so Taoism is the belief that the universe itself is basically a giant machine, a procedural system that is springs from a central force of creation called the Tao, that is basically the nature of this thing is creation and destruction, is just continual cycles of creation and destruction. And this is what the symbol that most people know, the yin yang of the sort of the black fish and the white fish, is just a way of understanding. It's a swirl. So that symbol is actually representing the continual, the nature of the physical universe is continual change. And Taoism is a study about how to think about living your life in a way that simply rows along with the currents that are already happening, regardless of how you're trying to be in your own life. And so as I was like going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, I was just thinking a lot about Taoism, and I think that so Taoists would believe that so everything we would need, this procedural system is self-correcting. So it will find a way to sort of return to harmony with natural law. And the book, I think, you know, so I think that Bitcoin, one way I think about Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is an obvious natural solution that occurred as a result of something unnatural, which is central banking. And the sort of procedural nature of all things is that everything that has its own cycle of sort of like birth and death. And so this cycle would apply to anything that exists that we've manufactured, and banking is one of those things. And so central banking is a system that is on its own life cycle, and that life cycle has produced an output of a society that it makes very difficult for people to actually live in harmony with natural law. And this is because as our efforts and our time are stolen from us, we kind of have to go out and steal from other people. And like, it just creates like a theft based society. When we're pulling all this value forward in debt, that debt doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from someone else, right? So if you need to own a home for 30 years and then you sell it to someone who needs to own it for 40 years, you're really like selling your home for their life. Like, they're giving you 40 years, like they're paying that forward to you, and you did it to someone else. And you know, this is just this is just how it is. So we all have to go
everyone up against each other, you
right?
Know? Like, and we are a species that really we're tribal. You know, we thrive when we work together and solve mm-hmm. problems together and think about the future together and build beautiful things together.
Yeah.
And all of this is completely ruined and flipped on its head by a financial system, like you said. It inherently gets people at each other's throats.
Yeah. Yeah, and so this is the core premise of the book. It's a philosophical exploration of how Bitcoin's alignment with natural law could and hopefully will envision a world where these social problems have been fixed.
Love it, man. That's what I would love to hear your thoughts on, like, what could that world look like? Do you ever visualize, you know, using what we now know or in what we theorize about what the past used to look like with these, you know, these pictures you mentioned about these beautiful cities and these free energy systems. And we didn't even talk about like the bells, the healing bells. I love that one. And just all these things that like help people be healthy and work with nature and be together and like have harmony with each other. Like, knowing that we used to be there and, you know, what we know now, could we bring that back and, you know, ascend even higher than that in the future?
Yeah, I think it's a vision of utopia. I mean, so I kind of think about it in two ways. You know, the book talks because, you know, like I mentioned this interest in consciousness, and Taoism itself is something that's like really experienced internally. So you start thinking about the world in a certain way, living a certain way, and that happens inside, and then that changes your sort of outside, you know, how the rest of the world sees you back. And so when I think about time to preference, you know, I think most commonly discuss it as this idea of like your spending decisions and like how you're spending your time. I think that the fiat money system, what it's really doing in shortening our time preference is forcing us to spend time out of the present moment. So we spend more time worrying about the future and more time regretting about the past and less time actually just thinking about right now. And we're at like peak fiat right now, and this problem is actually getting worse. You know, like you go to a restaurant and people are so dopamine depleted that they'll be sitting at a table with their five best friends, and all of them are actually looking at their phones, looking for pictures of people doing more exciting things somewhere else, people they don't even know. You know, like, and so we're so disconnected right now. And it's a symptom, I think, of people's inability to be in the present moment. So the first piece is, I think that, so I say, what is the Tao of Bitcoin? The Tao of Bitcoin is a sense of tranquility that accompanies a comprehension of energy money. And so I think the first thing that happens is when you really get Bitcoin, you can experience, like, hopefully a sense of freedom where, like, for me personally, I'm not really worried about the future anymore. And I spend most of my time right now, if I can, like with the person I'm talking to, with, you know, like admiring the walk I'm on. And so I think that happens. And I think that the cascade of that happening for everyone is what reimagines how we think about how we organize civilization. And so I do think these things that you said, like we will no longer tolerate disposable buildings made of cardboard and plastic. We will no longer, you know, and when there's a higher expectation of the beautification of stuff, we'll start stop treating it like crap. So, you know, you'll just start to see the end of how we think about, you know, all this sort of like disposable world stuff. If they really are fiat ideas, and so it's a total paradigm shift for me. And I think that this is another thing. I don't think this is like 50 years in the future, because Bitcoin is like, you know, it's a slow burn idea, but like you don't have to be an astronaut to figure it out. And once you do, like there aren't former Bitcoiners. I mean, there aren't many genuine ones, right? So to me, this is just like, we're going to hit a critical threshold where a certain number of people have understood this. And I talked about this in a presentation I gave at Canadian Bitcoin Conference in Montreal last year. It was something called 99 Monkeys Theory, where there was a long study about the behavior of monkeys that happened on the island of Koshima in Japan in the 50s, where they taught a certain group of monkeys how to wash sweet potatoes, and they made them taste better. And these monkeys started teaching it to each other. And at a certain level, once a certain number of monkeys, they say the 99 monkeys, there were monkeys on other parts of the island that had no interactions with each other that just started exhibiting the behavior. So there is so much to, I'm really interested in collective consciousness ideas. And I do think absolutely that we have an ability to communicate with each other in ways that we have no current comprehension of. So I fully believe in telepathy. I just think that we, you know, we've been drinking fluoride our whole lives, and we really are, you know, there is a whole nother rabbit hole around why a lot of these old buildings also have imagery and architecture around acorns. And I'll just leave that one for anyone who's listening. You can go down that rabbit hole on your own.
Wait, can you tell me more? I have no idea about that one. Is it too much?
So the acorn is, you know, I think that the center of this, you know, maybe more advanced consciousness stuff is the pineal gland.
Oh, that's right. The pineal gland. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, the acorns are everywhere in art and architecture. And this is just something, another thing that we maybe don't really understand right now.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I don't even, like, this episode has been like a just I don't even know how to angle this one because it's like just talking about the stuff kind of blows my brains out, you know?
Yeah.
It's going to take me some time to really go through all this content. And you mentioned the My Lunch Break YouTube channel. I watched like 3 or 4 of those videos after you recommended it to me. And I'm a grinder, so I want to go pull that thing up and just go through the whole thing because he does a great job just showing all these pictures of buildings, sort of like we've done this episode, kind of like throwing a bunch of the stuff out there at the listeners. I think this would be a great place to go next to sort of see it visually and start connecting it to things that you have in your past that you never really thought about. And you mentioned Seattle. That's a perfect one for me. I haven't seen the underground thing because I just thought, oh, like, that's just another like Seattle thing, like watching them throw the fish around and go to the Space Needle. And like, it's just like another tourist attraction, but this is like actually a huge thing. It's part of ancient history that was hidden from us. Mm-hmm. And I also saw a video last night on an Instagram reel of just a little bit south from there in Olympia, Washington, the capital has one of those gigantic Capitol buildings you talked about. And
those buildings are insane. Like, and if you really look at them, I'm like, yeah, it's just, it's hard to explain why they were built. And it's also really difficult to imagine like how, like how? They're just so ornate and like, beautiful and
the pillars
massive.
Are like, the pillars are like 5 feet diameter.
Yeah.
Like 40 feet tall of marble.
Yeah.
You're not, bringing that
and like
on
these
a
people
horse.
Would have been like outhouses, like fighting for survival. And then just all of a sudden deciding to knock out an eternal building in the middle of nowhere.
It makes like the stories we've been told about everything in terms of that, like after just sort of thinking about it for a while, watching these videos of people actually walking through the amount of detail. And I know so many of us think of the pyramids in Egypt as, which you actually saw. I haven't seen that one. I need to. But that's sort of the perfect example people think of where there's like this big mystery. Like, how did they move all those giant blocks? And I still don't freaking know. But there's a lot more than just the pyramids. There's stuff in people's own backyard out there you can look at that makes no sense.
You know? Oh, yeah, totally.
And once you just
there's pyramids bigger than Giza. You know, and like there's pyramids all over the U.S. There's pyramids in China, huge pyramids in Peru. Which is just another weird thing how like there was another global architectural monoculture way earlier where all of a sudden people somehow decided to all build pyramids at the same time. And we don't know how anybody was doing those either. Like, I have seen videos like we would have a really hard time with modern machinery moving single blocks the size of those that were, they were moving. I mean, and in Peru, like they have those bigger, like the megalith stones. I think Grant Hancock has them in one of his episodes where they're the size of buildings, single blocks, and they're cut to fit together with an accuracy you couldn't even slide a piece of paper in.
Like, perfectly. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, and that's, you know, that's a good example of another one where there's no way to explain this. You can't even try.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think it's just like, it's going to be really confusing if you have to shoehorn an explanation for why into like how we think about everything else. And I mean, Bitcoin, you know, the other thing I think is really interesting, I do think it's probably a technology that existed before. I think a lot of these things get kind of reintroduced. To me, actually, if you were going to have a free energy society, Bitcoin would be a completely necessary technology, because Bitcoin would be the ultimate free energy technology, because it would be the only way to quantify unlimited energy. And I talk about this in the book. It's like, it's the same thing, a perfectly finite thing. Another piece of Taoism has to do with kind of understanding duality and like sort of paradoxical duality, where you really can understand something by understanding like its mirror. And something that's perfectly finite is really maybe the thing that helps people understand the perfectly infinite. And I think this is actually why there's a little bit of an obstacle right now with Bitcoin, is most people still haven't comprehended the problem of infinite money, like truly. And so the solution of finite money is just kind of an abstract, making the connection if you haven't... found the one or the other. It's, you know, you kind of have to find one first.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like kind of bridging. That's the challenge that I talk about here all the time. Like, how do we bridge that gap for people? Because everyone on earth alive today should care about this, because it will fix everyone's, well, we like to be a little hyperbolic sometimes. It will fix pretty much everyone's problems that they're talking about. Like, the biggest problems in people's lives that they have right now usually come down to inflation. So many times it does.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin fixes that.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, going back to the previous point, right? Bitcoin fixes the way we interact with each other. Bitcoin fixes the way we imagine the physical world around us. Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes the way we think about governance. You know, like, I don't know that people have really like thought about how tax collection works in a system where money is unconfiscatable and like they can't send us all to jail. So I even wonder, you know, some of these ideas about President Trump and the end of income tax is like, if you knew ahead of time that we were all going to be using Bitcoin in 4 years anyways, the smart thing to do would be to get ahead of it and end income tax while you could use some political capital to make you look like a hero. And like, that's not a conspiracy theory. I wonder about, personally, I think, one theory I will say is that I think that the powers that be fully understand Bitcoin much, much better than the average person wants to give them credit for. So that includes Larry Fink and Jamie Dimon, but it actually probably more means all of the people who we have no idea who they are, who are really powerful. I would say it's not the case that, you know, a handful of internet nerds have figured something out that the rest of the world hasn't. That's people can take that however they will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, game on, man. I feel like it's one of those things that, you know, the people you mentioned, like Jamie Dimon and Larry Fink, they keep coming out and just having takes that just don't make sense. They go on TV and
Elon and Peter Thiel, and like nobody understands this stuff worse over time. Like, that's a major red flag. Don't take anything. I don't pay attention to what any of those people say publicly. Like, it's not even newsworthy. This is just, you know, this is the same as like, you know, if you're taking what Elon says about Bitcoin with any grain of truth, you've been watching too many moon landings, my friend.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Man, Scott, I think that this is one of those episodes where we've thrown so many things at people. This is a good place to sort of start wrapping things up. But before we do, I want to, as someone who myself is sort of just going through this rabbit hole, and people can probably tell that like I don't have a whole lot to like add to this conversation because I'm still learning it all and absorbing it all. I would love to just get a bunch of resources that were really helpful for you so we could help other people, myself included, go through this. And you mentioned My Lunch Break is a great YouTube channel. I'll put that in the description. I brought up The Primordial Code, a really good documentary by Marianne Poles, is one I think was a great intro. What else out there do you think people should be looking at to learn more about all this stuff?
There's an individual like content creator. I think he goes by Improbable Dreamer.
Oh, I know that one. He's great. Yeah.
So,
he's great.
So the dreamer, I think I found before Lunch Break, and his content is like really blown up. So I think that was probably the first one that I sort of saw. I've watched like lots of different, you know, like a great thread to start tugging on really hard is the World's Fair of Chicago. So I'm like, I think that's a really just cool place, and there's tons of content to find around that one, and I kind of like I have used if you find any of my I love speaking at Bitcoin conferences, and I've got a bunch kind of up on my YouTube, and you will find pictures of the World's Fair of Chicago Easter egg throughout those if you're interested.
We need to get all these people on Noster so they're safe from the.
Yeah.
If the algorithm ever turns against them, because it's kind of interesting to me. I talk about this sometime with other people, like even the most untouchable topics I'm realizing are sometimes like they're blown up on Instagram. Like it feels like the algorithm lords are sort of like losing control. It's impossible to block all of this stuff because there's so many people posting about it. So I'm not sure how to feel about that.
Or, you know, I think it you know, an alternative possibility is that this is an inevitable thing that, you know, I think it's like, I kind of think that anything that is happening at a large scale is being allowed to happen. So, for whatever reason, there could be, yeah.
It'll be
it might be happening
to watch.
By design.
Yeah. All we can do is watch it all unfold and sort of speculate on why things are happening the way they are. But I'm going to continue focusing on Nostr because I know that can't be taken away from me. So
totally.
Awesome, man. Well, I'll put the links to all this stuff in the show notes. I hope people enjoyed this. It's been a lot to swallow, which is what we love to do sometimes. We like to just throw shit at the wall and people can figure out what they want to. Your book, The Tao of Bitcoin, I'll make sure to include that in the show notes as well. And all the rest, Scott, where else can people find you? I think you kind of mentioned a couple there, but just let's make sure they do.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter a lot. I'm trying to spend more time on Nostr, but I honestly still spend more of my time on Twitter. The Twitter is Lantern Bitcoin. And that's probably the best place.
Great. Scott Deedles, thank you so much for coming by, man. It was an awesome conversation. It's great to meet you face to face digitally, and we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Ben. I appreciate you having me on.